welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian Lebeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Ever since novelist Bram Stoker brought him to the public's attention more than a century ago, Dracula has captured the imaginations of generations of people throughout the world. But while some believe the story is pure fiction, others find a basis for the tale in history. And that's the topic of this week's interview. We'll also be visited once again by Dr. America, who will provide us with a history of boredom that is anything but boring. But before we get to either of those topics, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. A long-lost tradition of an ancient civilization was reborn on April 6, 1896. The Olympic Games, an ancient Greek tradition that lay dormant for more than 1,500 years after they were banned by Roman Emperor Theodosius I, were reopened in Athens. First held in 776 BC, the ancient sporting event occurred every 4 years during a religious festival honoring the Greek god Zeus. The Olympics eventually fell victim to Theodosius' effort to suppress pagan practices in the Roman Empire, but modern Europe's increasing fascination with the ancient Greek culture spawned attempts at revival of the ancient sporting tradition. In 1892, a French baron, Pierre de Coubertin, proposed a revival of the Olympics as a major international competition. At a Paris International Sports Conference in 1894, 79 delegates from 9 countries unanimously approved Coubertin's proposal. The International Olympic Committee was formed, and the first modern Olympic Games were appropriately planned for Athens, Greece. The event, which opened this week in 1896, drew a crowd of 60,000 spectators and 280 athletes from 13 nations who competed in 43 events. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, members of the Dust Bowl Historical Foundation of Weed Patch, California, are trying to raise enough money to restore the original buildings of Weed Patch Camp, a facility opened in 1936 as a shelter for migrants known to history as the Okies. These dispossessed farmers from Oklahoma, Texas, and elsewhere trekked west in the desperate hope of escaping the clutches of the Dust Bowl and the Great Depression. Weed Patch Camp was immortalized in John Steinbeck's 1939 novel, The Grapes of Wrath. The camp is one of the few remaining vestiges of the fading Okie culture, one that thrived in desperate times and faded with the arrival of economic prosperity. And previously classified documents released from the National Security Archive show that Henry Kissinger, contrary to details laid out in his memoirs, pledged during a 1971 visit with the Chinese Prime Minister that the United States was willing to abandon diplomatic support of an independent Taiwan in exchange for China's help in bringing an end to the Vietnam War. The documents reveal a Nixon administration plagued with problems of an increasingly unpopular war, willing to make radical departures from previous policies and determined to withdraw from Vietnam. The 1971 meeting laid the groundwork for Nixon's historic visit to China in 1972. This is Talking History. For most of us, Dracula was Bela Lugosi, the actor who immortalized him in the movies. To those who have investigated the story, however, the character is based on the historical figure Vlad the Impaler. Talking History's Eileen Dugan explores that angle of the story with her guest this week, Kurt Treptow.
Thanks to Bram Stoker in Hollywood, the name of Dracula is forever associated with vampires, Bela Lugosi, and stakes through the heart. But, as so often is the case, nothing could be farther from the truth. And, as so often is the case, the true story of Vlad III Dracula may well be far better than any Hollywood film. With us today to discuss the real story of Vlad III Dracula is Dr. Kurt W. Treptow, director of the Center for Romanian Studies in Iași, Romania. Dr. Treptow is the author of Vlad III Dracula, The Life and Times of the Historical Dracula. Welcome, Dr. Treptow.
Thank you.
Who was Vlad III? I mean, was he Count Dracula of Transylvania?
No, he wasn't. That's strictly an invention of Bram Stoker. Vlad was actually a Romanian prince who ruled a principality called Wallachia, which is part of modern-day Romania, three times during the 15th century, briefly in 1448, a second time from 1456 to 1462, and a third and final reign, which he had at the end of 1476.
And what was the political setting of his life and his reign?
Wallachia was a small principality surrounded by very large empires. First of all, it was a time when the Ottoman Empire was in full expansion. Already by the end of the 14th century, the Ottoman Empire had established itself on the Danube River, which is the southern border for the Principality of Wallachia. The Kingdom of Hungary was a very large imperial power during this period. As to the north was the Kingdom of Poland, a very large imperial power. And these, the Romanian principalities, of which Wallachia was one, Moldavia being another, and Transylvania, which had already been taken over by the Hungarian kingdom, were small principalities sort of trapped in between these large empires and trying to struggle to preserve their own independence and existence during this time.
Why was Vlad III called Dracula?
Well, Vlad was called Dracula because of his father. His father, who was also named Vlad and would be Vlad II, a prince of Wallachia as well, had received a very prestigious award from the Holy Roman Emperor Sigismund of Luxembourg, called the Order of the Dragon, which was a crusading order given to people who were involved in fighting the Turks. And Vlad had received this award, and therefore he became known as Vlad Dracul. In Romanian in the 15th century, there was no difference between the dragon and devil. So Dracul today in modern Romanian means the devil, but at that time it meant the dragon, Vlad the Dragon, because of this award that he had received. This was a very very prestigious thing, and all of his sons, including Vlad, who would become Vlad III, would be called by this name, Dracula, the A ending meaning son of, essentially son of the dragon. And all of his sons would be known as this, and Vlad, when he became a prince later, would actually sign documents using this name, Dracula. So this would be his correct name, actually, Vlad Dracula.
So there were no sinister implications of this name, nothing demonic or anything?
No, just the unfortunate association with the devil, but this goes again back into Christian belief as well, because of the dragon being used symbolically as a representation of the devil. For example, the story of St. George and the dragon would be a good example of that. But there was no, the name Dracula and Dracul, his father's name, was actually a very prestigious thing, indicating that he was a great warrior fighting the Turks.
Another thing that I've heard him called is Vlad III the Impaler. Why was he called that?
Well, that's a name that actually came came later. He was never called that during his own lifetime in Romania. At all, he would be called Dracula. That was his real name. This name came about much later. First of all, it was a name that was used by Turkish chroniclers later, because of course Vlad had a great war with the Turks, and impalement was one of the forms that they used of torture, punishment of prisoners, and to intimidate an invading enemy force. So he would become. It would become known in Turkish sources as the Impaler, and this would also later, actually over 100 years after his death, would be used by in some Romanian sources mentioned and as Impaler. But in his own lifetime in his own country, he was never known by that name.
There are also tales of his being very cruel to his people, trying to enforce morality or other stories. Are these true as well?
Well, to some extent, those may be true in the sense that Vlad certainly was a ruler who tried to enforce justice and bring discipline to his country in an effort to preserve his own independence. However, most of the stories that are published, we can't take those as true historical sources because they were written for a whole different purpose, mainly political propaganda. The German stories, for example, about Vlad were written strictly for political propaganda purposes. The Slavic stories, which are the other main source for these sorts of tales, were written more as a guide for Russian rulers to what is a good and just prince, sort of a precursor of Machiavelli's The Prince in many ways. However, there's no doubt that Vlad certainly pursued that type of a policy, but we can't take the stories that evolved from that as being literally true.
But what kinds of stories, true or not, have been circulated about him?
Numerous stories. For example, some of the myths would be in the German stories, they present an image of a very cruel, demonic person, of which certainly helped later to make this transition from this cruel demonic prince into a vampire. Would certainly help to support that. Stories of him beheading people, boiling them in water, eating them, various tales like this, which most of which, of course, are not true at all. Either were just worked up for political propaganda purposes, which, again, is a whole other story as to how this image of Vlad became created. Had Vlad not lived in the middle of the 15th century, we probably wouldn't know about him today. The main cause for his fame, of course, was the spread of the printing press, which, of course, he was a contemporary with Gutenberg and the beginning of printing. And the first the German stories that came out as basically as political propaganda against Vlad had a wide circulation throughout Europe and actually became some of the first bestsellers in Europe. And this would account a great deal for his fame. Now, we can ask why did this all happen? Why was this political propaganda used against Vlad? And there's a very very simple explanation for that, actually. In 1462, Vlad launched a great war against the Turks. He wanted to stop Turkish influence in his own country. A couple of years before, the Pope, Pius II, had called for a great crusade of European nations against the Turks to drive them out of Europe. Vlad was to spearhead this crusade, which involved many other countries, including Vlad's ally, in whom he helped to put on the throne the king of Hungary at that time, Matthias Corvinus. Matthias Corvinus had received large sums of money, subsidies, from the Pope in order to prepare this expedition against the Turks, which Vlad began attacking Turkish positions all along the Danube during the winter of 1461 and 1462. The Turks, of course, prepared their response in the spring of 1462, organizing a large campaign which would enter Wallachia in the summer of that year. However, Matthias Corvinus was not actually interested in fighting Turks. He was having problems with the Habsburgs and wanting to gain control of the imperial throne in Vienna. He wanted to use the Pope's money for that purpose. So letting Vlad begin his campaign against the Turks suited well his policy and allowed him to obtain subsidies from the Pope to finance his other interests, while at the same time, Matthias never came to Vlad's aid, and eventually would wind up arresting him, saying that he had conspired with the Sultan, something which he hadn't done, and which documents were forged to try and support that position. But then they began a whole series with his Saxon allies, who had no love for Vlad, as they had been on the opposite side during the wars in Transylvania in the years before that. They began to circulate a whole series of stories of Vlad's cruelty and creating this monstrous image so that they could support the fact that Matthias did not come to Vlad's aid and undertake the war against the Turks to justify what he had done with all the Pope's money, essentially. And this would be sort of the beginnings of Vlad's deformation into a very cruel and demonic figure. So Matthias arrested him. He would spend 12 years in prison. But after that, he was released by the same king of Hungary, who, at that time, politics had changed, and he was actually interested in fighting the Turks, and he knew that Vlad was a good man for that purpose, and he helped worked to put him on the throne again. Something, of course, if you were this deranged, maniacal person, Matthias certainly would never have undertaken to put such an unstable person on the throne when he was trying to undertake a very serious war against the Turks in 1475-1476. So Vlad would again regain the throne at that time for his final time and eventually be killed in battle against the Turks.
So despite Vlad's German image of being a cruel and demonic prince, could he be viewed as a national hero as well?
Well, he can be, for Romanians, be viewed as a national hero. That's been exaggerated to a great extent. However, there are two sides to the myth of Dracula, of the real Dracula. One, of course, is the Western image of the vampire and this very, very cruel, deranged man who's impaling people all the time. The other side of the coin is the communist historiography, which deformed Vlad into this great national hero who, communist historiography had him defeating the Turks in battle, actually, in 1462, and losing his throne only because he was betrayed by the landowners in the country, of course, fitting in with the typical communist stereotype of the cruel landowner and the oppressed peasants, and Vlad was the defender of the peasants, and so that would be one of the communist myths. Another would make Vlad essentially the father of centralized state economic planning, if they went that far even, misusing various documents to try and justify their cause, simply by taking fragments and then ignoring other parts of the document to justify that sort of an argument. However, Vlad certainly can be considered a national hero in a sense for Romanians because he did fight to try and defend the independence of his country against the Turks. He tried to play off the large foreign powers one against the other surrounding him in order to maintain a degree of independence. He wasn't extremely successful at it, but he certainly made a great effort. He also did several other things that are very important in the institutional development of his country. One of those being putting the church under national control, the Orthodox Church in his principality. Up until Vlad's reign, the Metropolitan of the Church had always been named from Constantinople. The Turks, having taken over Constantinople only 3 years before Vlad came to the throne for the second time, gave him the occasion to change that and to make the new Metropolitan, who was the head of the Church and the Principality, having him named from one of the most important monasteries in the country, so making him a local person rather than someone coming in from the outside. He would also be the prince under which the modern-day capital of Romania, Bucharest, began its own development. For the first time, Bucharest is actually mentioned in documents during Vlad's reign, and would begin to become sort of a second capital and eventually the principal capital of the principality as we get into the 16th century. So he's important for a number of reasons in Romanian history, and can legitimately be considered a national hero as long as that's not taken to certain extremes and exaggerations, which unfortunately has been the case in a lot of the Romanian historiography surrounding him.
Well, speaking of exaggerations, I think we need to turn to Bram Stoker and what he did to Vlad III. How did he get turned into a vampire?
Well, the main thing is that Bram Stoker created his vampire character and then looked for a name for him. He didn't create him, first of all, with the image of Vlad in his mind. It's just he didn't really know very much, in fact, about Vlad as a historical person, and this is very true from Stoker's own notes. I mean, this can be demonstrated. But the name and a few mentions in some travelers' writings from the early 19th century gave Bram Stoker the idea to name this character, which he had already created in a whole series of notes and everything for this story, led him to associate the name Dracula with this vampire and place him in this region of Europe. Now, he placed him in Transylvania, of course, which Vlad himself lived in Transylvania for a very short period of time during his life, and really wasn't of Transylvanian origin. He was the southern part of Romania, Transylvania being the northeastern part. So, really, I mean, it's just a very loose association of the name. And when you in Stoker's novel, of course, there's really nothing that really ties directly into the historical person. In fact, the only time that really starts to come through is actually in the Francis Ford Coppola film from the beginning of the 1990s, when they actually try and make a direct connection between the historical Vlad and the vampire Dracula.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Trepto.
Okay, thank you.
We have been talking with Dr. Kurt W. Trepto, director of the Center for Romanian Studies in Iași, Romania, author of Vlad the Third Dracula, The Life and Times of the Historical Dracula.
For our site of the week, we've chosen two sites, one real, one virtual, where you can learn more about Dracula and his historical roots in the heart of Transylvania. Here to tell you about them is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
What better way to experience Dracula than a trip to Transylvania on the Dracula Tour? Here in the heart of northern Romania, you can meet the myth and travel the legend. 1 week, 2 week, and 18-day tours are offered to Transylvania and various parts of northern Romania through Dracula Tours. And if you're tired of the same old Halloween party, then log on to DraculaTour.com and sign up for the 2002 Halloween Dracula Tour that includes a tour of Transylvania and an all-night costume party at a local castle. And if you can't make it to Transylvania in person, well, you can learn more about the man who may have inspired the myth. Visit Don Linke's webpage at donlinke.com and click on Dracula the Rock Opera, where you will find a link to the historical Dracula. Here you can learn about the origins of the name, the life of Vlad the Impaler and his father, the origins of the vampire myth, and historical background on the social and political forces of the region during the 15th century.
Sometimes people make history in war, or invention, or with a mighty stroke of the pen. But most of us make history less dramatically, sometimes, in fact, by doing nothing. This week, from the magnificent but wholly imaginary American Studies Museum, Dr. America explores the cultural contours of the history of boredom.
Boredom is the state or condition of being bored or uninterested. It's ennui. 21% of Americans confess that they are regularly bored, and researchers expect that the real number is probably higher. A recent Yankelevich poll finds a boredom boom, with more Americans looking for novelty in their lives. Boredom is a modern invention. In her lively book, Boredom, Patricia Spax notes the historical the word bore first appeared in the 18th century, when ideas of leisure and the pursuit of happiness came to center stage. At that time, it described people who were uninteresting because of their own moral deficiency. By the 19th century, when the word boredom first appeared, it connoted a kind of sociological fatalism. In the 20th century, boredom changed again. It's no longer seen as a moral deficiency. It's understood as a poverty of stimulation. The responsibility for boredom has moved from the self to the society. To some extent, boredom is the byproduct of the historical disenchantment of the world. For most of human history, nature was enchanted, literally alive with sprites and spirits. People of the past generally knew how to ritualize the magical and the mysterious, even the miraculous. But in an age of reason, nature and the world are disenchanted, drained of spirit and mystery. When our primary reality is sensory or scientific, people lose a sense of attachment and engagement. Boredom is also a product of the people who want to sell us products. It's one of the consequences of an expanding consumer culture, because businesses need boredom to sell novelty. Fashion is not just a way of clothing ourselves, it's a way of covering up our boredom. And new and improved products are popular not just because they're better, but because they're literally novelties. Historically speaking, boredom is also the shadow side of amusement and entertainment. In his provocative book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, cultural critic Neil Postman suggests that we live in the age of show business, which makes entertainment the natural format for the representation of all experience. So you would think that we wouldn't be bored. But in Enchanting a Disenchanted World, sociologist George Ritzer suggests that modern entertainment institutions, from Las Vegas casinos to amusement parks to shopping malls, raise the threshold of boredom. The more stimulated we become, it seems, the more stimulation we need to be satisfied. As a society, says Mary Catherine Bateson in her thoughtful book, Peripheral Visions, Learning Along the Way, we have become so addicted to entertainment that we have buried the capacity for awed experience of the ordinary. Perhaps the sense of the sacred is more threatened by learned patterns of boredom than it is by blasphemies. In many ways, she suggests, boredom is a failure of the modern imagination. From the American Studies Museum, this is Dr. America, boring at American history from within.
You've been listening to Dr. America, Professor of History James Farrell at St. Olaf College. Farrell's commentary comes to us courtesy of WCAL-FM in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota. This is Talking History. And finally, turning to our recommendations of coming attractions, a new visual culture developed in American cities in the early 20th century. Across disciplines, key scholars described the strongly new visual aesthetic within urban centers as ruled by an unabashed display of visuality, the rapid crowding of changing images, and a rigorous competition of diverse stimuli. The rising culture of commercialism hastened the appearance of this new visual culture, as did the new modes of commuter transportation by providing new views on the city and greater access to its attractions. The jarring stimuli of amusement parks and popular theatrical events heightened this experience, as you will see in a new exhibit, On the Edge of Your Seat, Popular Theater and Film in Early 20th Century American Art, to open on April 21st at the Wiseman Art Museum in Minneapolis. The exhibit runs through August 4th, during which time the museum will host a number of public lectures and symposia on related topics. Be sure to call ahead for a schedule of those events. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Talking History is a production of Creighton University and the Organization of American Historians. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.